The United States has a very sordid and disturbing history when it comes to drugs. Humanity has utilized the healing and spiritual benefits of natural plants, aka illegal drugs, as far back as the earliest writings found in recorded human history. With that being said, why is it that only within the last 100 years has it become so taboo and the government has made it criminal to possess and or use these natural substances? The answer will perhaps surprise you. Today, we'll discuss the story behind the war on drugs. In the 1960s, drugs became a symbol of youthful rebellion, social upheaval, and political dissent. The government halted scientific research to evaluate their medical safety and efficiency. Many illegal drugs, such as marijuana, opium, coca, and psychedelics, have been used for thousands of years for both medicinal and spiritual purposes. So why are some drugs legal and other drugs illegal today? It's not based on any scientific assessment of the relative risks of these drugs. It has everything to do with who is associated with these drugs. The first anti-opium laws in the 1870s were directed at Chinese immigrants. The first anti-cocaine laws in the early 1900s were directed at black men in the South. The first anti-marijuana laws in the Midwest and the Southwest in the 1910s and 1920s were directed at Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans. Today, Latino and Black communities are still subject to widely disproportionate drug enforcement and sentencing practices. Drug use for medicinal and recreational purposes has been happening in the United States since the country's inception. In the 1890s, the popular Sears and Roebuck catalog included an offer for a syringe and a small amount of cocaine for $1.50. At that time, cocaine use had not been outlawed. In some states, laws to ban or regulate drugs were passed in the 1800s, and the first congressional act to levy taxes on morphine and opium took place in 1890. The Smoking Opium Exclusion Act in 1909 banned the possession, importation, and use of opium for smoking. However, opium could still be used as a medicine. This was the first federal law to ban the non-medicinal use of a substance, although many states and countries had banned alcohol sales previously. In 1914, Congress passed the Harrison Act, which regulated and taxed the production, importation, and distribution of opiates and cocaine. Alcohol prohibition laws quickly followed. In 1919, the 18th Amendment was ratified, banning the manufacture, transportation, or sale of intoxicating liquors, ushering in the Prohibition era. The same year, Congress passed the National Prohibition Act, also known as the Volstead Act, which provided guidelines on how to federally enforce prohibition. Prohibition lasted until December 1933, when the 21st Amendment was ratified, overturning the 18th. In 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act was passed. The federal law placed a tax on the sale of cannabis, hemp, or marijuana. The act was introduced by Robert L. Dalton of North Carolina and was drafted by Harry Anslinger. While the law didn't criminalize the possession or the use of marijuana, it included hefty penalties if taxes weren't paid, including a fine of up to $2,000 and 5 years in prison. President Richard Nixon signed the Controlled Substance Act, CSA, into law in 1970. This statute calls for the regulation of certain drugs and substances. The rise in recreational drug use in the 1960s likely led to President Nixon's focus on targeting some types of substance abuse. As part of the War on Drugs initiative, Nixon increased federal funding for drug-controlled agencies and proposed strict measures, such as mandatory prison sentencing for drug crimes. He also announced the creation of the Special Actions Office for Drug Abuse Prevention, which was headed by Dr. Jerome Jaffe. Nixon went on to create the Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, in 1973. This agency is a special police force committed to targeting illegal drug use and smuggling in the United States. At the start, the DEA was given 1,470 special agents and a budget of less than $75 million. Today, the agency has nearly 5,000 agents and a budget of $2.03 billion. During a 1994 interview, President Nixon's domestic policy chief, John Ehrlichman, provided inside information suggesting that the War on Drugs campaign had ulterior motives, which mainly involved helping Nixon keep his job. In the interview conducted by journalist Dan Brom and published in Harper Magazine, John explained that the Nixon campaign had two enemies, the anti-left and black people. His comments led many to question Nixon's intentions in advocating for drug reform and whether racism played a role. John was quoted as saying, "We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black, but by getting the public to associate the hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing both heavily, we could disrupt these communities. We could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did." In the mid-1970s, the war on drugs took a slight hiatus. Between 1973 and 1977, 11 states decriminalized marijuana possession. Jimmy Carter became president in 1977 after running on a political campaign to decriminalize marijuana. During his first year in office, the Senate committee voted to decriminalize up to 1 ounce of marijuana. In the 1980s, President Ronald Reagan reinforced and expanded many of Nixon's war on drugs policies. In 1984, his wife Nancy Reagan launched the Just Say No campaign, which was intended to highlight the dangers of drug use. President Reagan's refocus on drugs and the passing of several penalties for drug-related crimes in Congress and state legislators led to a massive increase in incarcerations for nonviolent drug crimes. In 1986, Congress passed the Anti-Drug Abuse Act, which established mandatory minimum prison sentences for certain drug offenses. This law was later heavily criticized as having racist ramifications because it allocated longer prison sentences for offenses involving the same amount of crack cocaine used more by black Americans as powder cocaine used more by white Americans. 5 grams of crack triggered an automatic 5-year sentence, while it took 500 grams of powdered cocaine to merit the same sentence. Critics also pointed to data showing that people of color were targeted and arrested on suspicion of drug use at higher rates than whites. Overall, the policies led to a rapid rise in incarcerations for nonviolent drug offenses, from 50,000 in 1980 to 400,000 in 1997. In 2014, nearly half of the 186,000 people serving time in federal prison in the United States had been incarcerated on drug-related charges, according to the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Public support for the war on drugs has waned in recent decades. Some Americans and policymakers feel the campaign has been more ineffective and has led to racial divide. Between 2009 and 2013, some 40 states took steps to soften their drug laws, lowering penalties and shortening mandatory minimum sentences, according to the Pew Research Center. In 2010, Congress passed the Fair Sentencing Act, FSA, which reduced the discrepancy between crack and powder cocaine offenses from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. The recent legalization of marijuana in several states and the District of Columbia has also led to more tolerant political views on recreational drug use. Technically, the war on drugs is still being fought, but with less intensity and publicity than in its earlier years. Today, we have a very special guest joining us on the podcast. Gentlemen, please welcome Simone Gerges from the Georgia chapter of Decriminalize Nature.
Hello, Simone.
Hey, guys.
Welcome to the show today.
Thanks for adding beauty to our lineup.
Yeah, Simone was so gracious to join us. Basically, I was watching a documentary, and I can't even remember what it was now, on Netflix. And at the end of the documentary, they started talking about Decriminalized Nature. And I thought, oh my gosh, that sounds amazing. So I was like, because there were different chapters, right? There were different chapters of it. And I thought, is there a Georgia chapter? And I found it on Instagram and reached out to Simone and said, hey, would you like to join us? And she did.
Yes. I love it. I love it.
Yeah, thank you guys. This is exciting.
Oh, we're excited to have you.
Whenever I'm talking with friends, this is something that is near and dear to my heart, actually, because I think the analogy is so funny. You know, you, like you said, Todd, 100 years ago, all of a sudden it was like, you see that plan over there? You see that? You can't have it. No, mm-mm. It's illegal. And you're like, it grew out of the ground. I don't understand. Get away from it. You get away. Yeah. It's illegal.
Like it's, you see that mushroom over there? Something.
Yeah, that one that grows right there in the cow patty. Yeah, that's illegal. Get away it's from bizarre. It. You know. And then all of a sudden it's like dun dun dun. You know, you think of the song dun 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 da 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 da. Right. Pill, pill, pill.
Oh, pill. Absolutely.
And they're like, that you can have, but that over there in the ground, no. And you're like,
okay. Yeah.
This
it's
is
weird
so
that
weird,
there's something like, called decriminalized nature, right? Just yeah, the yeah. fact that we have to decriminalize nature, it's just bizarre
I
to
know.
Me.
Yeah.
That's so what, weird. How did you get involved with decriminalized nature? Like, what kind of give us some of your story that led up to you saying, I want to be a part of this?
Sure. You know, when I was younger, I struggled with depression and anxiety. And, you know, when I was like 18, I was in college and my counselor recommended that I go see a psychiatrist. And so I did. I was 18. Mm-hmm. And my psychiatrist immediately put me on an SSRI and put me on anti-anxiety medication. And I had very rudimentary knowledge of those kinds of pharmaceutical drugs. And I trusted my doctor. And I was on that SSRI. And for me, it took all of my emotions away. So I'm a very emotional person. Mm-hmm. I feel my emotions very deeply. So when I'm sad, I'm really sad. When I'm apathetic, I'm really apathetic. I'm just an extremist in that way. And it freaked me out that nothing, I couldn't feel anymore, you know, like nothing. I love music. I would put my headphones in and listen to music and nothing sounded good anymore. You know, like I couldn't find a song that made me feel anything. Food didn't taste good. I started becoming kind of antisocial. Nothing felt good anymore. And nothing felt bad. I just didn't feel anything.
No emotions.
Yeah. So it really freaked me out to kind of live in this like black and white state. And I was really missing my color. Like I even missed my depression. I was like, damn, like, I miss being sad like that, you know? And so I kind of stayed on the SSRI for like 6 months. And then by that time I was just like this, I felt awful, you know, like life just was so meaningless. And so then I decided to come off of my medication and my psychiatrist told me to taper down over 2 weeks. Well, I think I was supposed to taper down for a longer period of time. Oh. And in that tapering down, I became just, I don't know, like I felt awful in a way that I just didn't want to be alive. It was the first time that I really had deep suicidal thoughts. I stayed that way for like a year. And I just suffered in my classes. So I had to withdraw from all my classes in school and I was desperate, you know, and everybody around me was worried about me because I tend to be a vivacious person. And, you know, for the better half of a year and a half, I just wasn't myself anymore. So
it was clear to your family and friends that something was going on. You weren't you.
Right. Yeah. And I couldn't find the help I needed. You know, I was searching. I wanted to get back to myself. So my parents, my mom at the time, I think it was my 20th birthday, she bought me a trip to Costa Rica and I was getting my scuba diving license there, like my open water certification. She thought like that would, you know, I dropped out of college technically. She's like, why don't you do something that you really like? So while I was there, I was staying with some friends in an Airbnb, and they gave me mushrooms one night.
That's right.
And, you know,
now, was that your first time to ever try anything like that?
Yeah, okay. It was. So I had heard about psilocybin, and, you know, I'd heard about people using it for depression. I think it was Rick Straussman. And, you know, I'd heard about it, and it was on my mind. Like, I was like, I want to take some acid. I want to take some mushrooms. So when the opportunity presented itself, I was like, hell yeah, give me those, you know? And I think I had like 5 grams of penis envy mushrooms. And we were on a beach, and we had a bonfire. And I was just kind of sitting there, and we were looking at the stars. And all of a sudden, this like rush, it was maybe like an hour and a half later, other people who had tripped before started tripping before me. But this like rush came over me, and I just started crying. Like, I couldn't stop. So like these tears were just running out of my eyes. And it was like, I knew that it was this pent up emotional trauma and turmoil for years. And I could like feel it being released out of these like crocodile tears in my eyes. And I just cried silently and while we were out there for like an hour, just tears kept running out of my face. And then finally I felt this like sense of release. So I was like, I'm going to go for a walk, guys. You know, I'll be right back. And I went, I walked on the beach, and I just felt this overwhelming feeling of my connection to everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I felt connected to the water. And every grain of sand that I touched, it was like a part of my being, and mm-hmm. the stars. And I just felt so much meaning. It was the first time that I had felt meaning in a while, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And it was so comforting to remember that I was a part of all of this. And that I was connected to everyone and everything. And I found beauty in what people were calling depression and anxiety. It was unease in my body. It was my body telling me like, hey, like something's not balanced here. You know, your core beliefs might be a little skewed. And it was in that moment that, I changed my perception of what depression is in me. And I haven't been depressed since. I've been advocating for mushrooms specifically, but entheogens in general, after I tried, you know, ayahuasca, peyote, and had very similar, very intense experiences of love and connectedness and meaning. And so that's how I got into this. I've helped a lot of other people get off of SSRIs by sharing my testimony. You know, there's a lot of desperate people out there that are on pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
And they don't know that
I'm on Lexapro.
Other options. Yeah, I mean, there's just
Lexapro is pretty tame.
Yeah.
Lexapro seems pretty tame, but if I were to, if I were to get off it for a week, I'd get the brain zaps and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. And that happened to my wife as well. She went through a bit of depression as well. And she got on, I think it was Lexapro as well. And she was an entire zombie. It, like you mentioned, all those things. You couldn't feel happy. You couldn't feel sad. You couldn't feel. Yeah. And same thing happened to her where she got off of it and those brain zaps. Oh my gosh. Mm-hmm. Like it was.
Yeah, they're real.
It's real. Yeah.
Yeah.
I had hurt my back years ago, and I went to see the doctor, and the doctor says, well, we can put you on some narcotics. And I said, listen, I really don't want to be on those things. And he says, well, there's this newer drug out called tramadol. It's non-habit forming. And it's not an opioid. I said, okay, great. Well, 5 years later, I was addicted to that stuff.
I mean,
buying that stuff on the black market because I had to take it. To function normally, I had to take it. And then I got so fed up with it one day that I just stopped. I didn't wean. I just stopped. And for 2 months, I fought coming off of that. And really, one of the things that helped, one of the only things that helped, which I was already 3 weeks in fighting this, was my wife got me some marijuana. And it helped alleviate, because I mean, I was in and out of the bath, you know, just trying to, oh man, my body was falling apart. It was insane. So I get it. I get the difference between a pharmaceutical and a natural substance. And it does. So you had mentioned that, you know, you were going through this depression. And the first time you take a psychedelic mushroom, it snaps you out of this depression. So
yeah,
how does that work?
I think it works on your core beliefs, right?
Mm-hmm.
Some people have faith in things that they cannot see. I envy those people.
yeah, I agree.
Taking a psychedelic is, it's tangible evidence of something greater than yourself. You know, it's not a belief system that I made up to believe or somebody else made up. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to adhere to this. This sounds mm-hmm. good to me. This is in your face. It's an experience.
Yes. It's a personal experience. Yourself.
Yes. And it's an experience with a tangible energy that, you know, people call Pachamama or people call interconnectedness or God even. Mm-hmm. You know, it's that experience with the other that you're a part of. Does that make sense?
It does.
So it's
100%.
It's just, it changes your core beliefs. And when I realized that I was a part of something so powerful and benevolent and connected and intelligent, mm-hmm. it made me feel whole inside. And it changed my perception in an instant because I was like, oh, that's what's going on, you know? And before I was, you know, when you're 18 and in your early 20s, you're wondering, like, I don't know, I had these questions, but I was like, where are we? How did we get here? Who made mm-hmm. God? You know, like, this doesn't make mm-hmm. any sense. Like, I want to know who I am. Like, where did I come from? And this gave me an answer.
Yeah. You know, and you said,
I have a question about your ayahuasca experience.
Sure.
For sure. Todd, I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, you're fine.
What were you going to say, man?
Oh, I was just going to say that you use the word intelligence, and I agree wholeheartedly with you with that word. It's interesting that that has never really come to my mind, but you're absolutely right. It is the tap into intelligence, into this greater thing. And as you had mentioned, call it what you will.
What was that library you used to call it? The library?
Akashi, the Akashic Library?
The Akashi Codex.
The Akashic Records.
Yeah, the Akashic Records. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's amazing that there is stuff out there. And, you know, obviously we'll dive more into this when we start talking about why it's illegal at some point. But, you know, I just don't think that, you know, our governmental systems really want us to be awakened. They don't want us to, you know, I don't know. I mean, the best way to say it, they don't want us to be awake.
Well, I mean,
you know, there's this whole movement of wokeness and, you know, that's totally different. That is totally different thing. And, you know, to me, I'm a little bit older and it's hard for me to totally understand it, but I use the word woke years ago, but it meant more of what you're talking about. You're awake. You can see. You've connected to something else. Yeah.
You know, the third eye is open.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tim, what were you
saying? There's so much to all this. You know, Todd, you're saying some things that I definitely think powers that be would definitely want to stamp out in the public, because if the more aware we are, the less we're going to need the government. I don't know. You know, the more aware and self-sufficient we are in with ourselves and what truth is, the less we need the powers that are here and the money flow that's helping it. And that's a little conspiracy theory, but it's kind of interesting, right? Because let's look at it. Like, okay, ayahuasca, for example. Now, Simone, you tell me. I've heard a lot about it, and I mean, I'd love to try it myself just because I think it's an interesting little, oil. But like, the fact that I've heard people, you know, talking with star people or some geometric being, you know, having like a whole year's worth of psychotherapy in an hour or weekend, you know, a whole year's worth of talking with a therapist all in one weekend with your shaman. Did you go to a shaman? Did you have to go to a place and, you know, fight off the bugs and everything?
Yeah. So my first experience was also in Costa Rica after my mushroom experience. That trip turned into plant medicine welcoming. I didn't. So we got the ayahuasca from a shaman. And me and my friend, who also makes ayahuasca, that I met while I was there, we sat together with the ayahuasca, which ended up being much more powerful than any of the ceremonies that I sat in with, you know, shamans. That market has kind of been saturated. You know, there are some really good traditional shamans, but there are also people who are trying to commodify the retreat experience. And so I found that taking ayahuasca on my own, after I learned how to take it with an experienced person, you want to do that first, but it was more powerful. Because ayahuasca is the teacher. So you drink it, ayahuasca, and then she teaches you how to have a relationship with her. And this is, ayahuasca is
what,
tangible.
Who is she?
So ayahuasca is a tangible entity.
I see. I didn't know that.
Yeah. So historically, if you look at tribes like the Shipibo tribe of Peru, they've been taking ayahuasca for a long time. And their culture is almost centered around ayahuasca. And ayahuasca is an entity. It's, you know, Christians talk about angels coming to them or, you know, things like that. Ayahuasca is that for them, for these all these tribes that take ayahuasca ceremonially and sacramentally. So they say it's an entity, and they are right. And every single time I have taken ayahuasca, she appears to me like this, you know, in my face, tangible, like she's in the room.
The same entity?
No, so it's always ayahuasca, right? But ayahuasca has shown up as a tree, like from Pocahontas, you know, the weeping willow tree. She kind of has like a wooden face to me sometimes. She's shown up in like a serpent, like a boa constrictor, a jaguar, a spider. She kind of changes forms, but there's this sense that she is an ancient, omniscient, like benevolent healer and helper and ally to humanity. And I know it sounds, you know, woo-woo, and I try to stay away from the woo-woo-ness because there's also so much science behind this, but that is my experience, and almost everybody else that takes ayahuasca has an experience with the other.
Interesting.
It's fascinating.
Is there truly a leaving the layers of humanity? Like, do you feel like you're there for 1,000 days and it's only been 15 minutes? Like, is there a time, like, warp in a sense? I've heard that.
Absolutely.
Afterlife feeling, near death experience, sort of, right?
Yeah, you know, every time you take it, it's a little different. You don't know what's going to happen, but it's always what you need. you know? Mm. She can like sense your energy. But yeah, definitely had experiences that were time warp where I felt like I had spent, you know, days with her, and you know, it was 8 hours. I've had the near death experience where I was taken kind of in a space where I forgot who I was, you know, I wasn't Simone anymore. And I kept trying to remind myself, like, you're Simone, like you're sitting on the grass and you're outside of the cabin and this is where you are. And all of a sudden I was kind of taken into an empty blank space where I was nothing. And I thought to myself, am I dead? You know, I asked ayahuasca, because she's like with you the whole time on your journey. And I was like, am I dead? And she was like, no, like this is who you really are, you know? And wow. Yeah, it felt like death, you know, it felt like Simone, that this person was dead, and all that was left was like the energy that makes up my consciousness. And then we kind of went back and built it back in.
Kind of what you're saying too, which is interesting, because if you listen to even people that are Christian and they give a near-death experience, as you kind of talked about that all of a sudden you knew you were you, but kind of the further you went along in this journey, you started to separate from you, right?
Yes.
And you hear that in many near-death experiences where as they travel along on their journey, they're kind of missing their loved ones, they're understanding where they came from, but the further they go along, that starts to dissipate and they become one with whatever this is. And it sounds very similar. So it's so interesting, you know, when you look at all these different religious belief systems, that they're all so gung-ho on, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right, I'm right. And the reality, I think this is just me, and you know, but I think they're all pulling from the same pot. And here you are having this experience. And in this experience, you're feeling all the same things that all these other religions are talking about. So it's all coming from something. There is something. There just has to be, right?
Yeah.
And some people will debate that. But I just don't think you can negate the experience that you're having and that other people are having, even from religious beliefs. The thing that I dislike about all of it is that we fight over it, right? I'm right. So going back to kind of the decriminalized nature and you taking these substances that are kind of healing and not only physically, but spiritually, it almost seems that the best thing for all of us to do as humanity is to have that kind of experience, right?
Or be able to choose if you want to have that experience, right?
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Michelle and I heard when Michelle and I, my wife's name, her name is Michelle, and she's been on this podcast a couple times before. But anyhow, she and I were chatting about this very thing the other day in the car about legalization. And, you know, my family, I'll just give you a couple quick snapshot of my family. Very conservative. You know, my parents were missionaries. I'm a pastor's kid, MK. Do I believe in Jesus Christ? Yes, I do. I'm the one that would blindly believe in him, even though it happened 2000 years ago, you know, this is a little crazy, but that's just kind of how I grew up. But at the same time, you know, I'm not going to die on that hill and lose a friendship over it either. Right. You know, those are my theological upbringings and my little things. But with that, my wife and I were chatting about, the whole legalization of drugs, recreational drugs. And it was funny because she was thinking I would just take this a stance of like, no, I want it to be illegal, maybe due to the fact that my, you know, my upbringing. But I'm actually more or less like, no, I don't think it should be illegal. I don't even, well, okay, there should definitely be some substances that, you know, that we obviously didn't create out of the ground, like meth, where I felt like there's a witch who was like, here's a recipe for, you know, first you get some lithium and the bat of Newt and then you've got, you know, meth. That's a little crazy. You know, cocaine, it does come from a leaf, but then you look at the process and how they make it and it's like, okay, you basically throwing me back in a lab. And so maybe there's some of those things where you go, I don't know about those, but the big guys, the marijuanas and the psilocybins. I think, why not, right? And people should have the right to do it. And who is it? Why is it that we care about, you know, whether Todd or not is going to go out and smoke a joint tonight? You know, why? What does that matter? Like, it's his choice. He should be allowed to. And it would help a lot with our jail system and the money and, you know, I don't know. There's a lot we could talk there about, but it was just funny. My argument with my wife, you know, like, because there's a little piece of it that's walled around with my own religious beliefs and growing up, you know, it would offend a lot of people, you know, kind of thing. If they heard that I did actually want to make things legal. Because I really don't, you know, there's a lot of things that I'm like, why? It's so stupid. Like, it's the dumbest thing that's illegal.
Yeah, anyway, I agree. I come from a Coptic Orthodox Christian background. So I'm the first person in my bloodline to leave Egypt. So my family is like fundamentalist Christians. Like Coptic Orthodox Christians predate Catholicism. It's one of the oldest sects of Christianity, and they still keep it. They haven't changed it. You know, we still, the liturgy is in Coptic, which is old Arabic.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, when I first came out and started talking about these things, my family, when I tried to explain to my mother what ayahuasca was, she thought it was a demon. Because that's just her upbringing, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And I was like, no.
Yeah, right. You have to experience it, Mom. You don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. And in my research, because I had a Christian background, I've always been fascinated with the Bible and the Dead Sea Scrolls. And, you know, I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think there's a reason that book is so influential on humanity. I mean, what other book has had that big of an influence? There has to be a reason, right? But in my research, there are certain things in the Bible that really make, after having psychedelic experiences with plants and fungi, there are certain parts of the Bible where I'm like, that must be a mushroom, you know, the sacrament must be a mushroom. And when I looked into it, I'm not the only person that believes that. There's a whole...
You're not.
I would argue
the burning bush.
All of Revelations,
man.
I know, right? All of Revelations, written by John, a disciple of Jesus, was on an island of Patmos, which is popular, a popular place for where oracles would go to get the gas that came from the earth, where they would have their dreams for the, you know, Roman emperor or whatever, like to whether they should go into battle or something, you know. But there he was, banished to that island, and now we've got Revelations to deal with, you know, because you get the ones, the real right wing conservative Christian, they're
Revelations
like, we're all
going to
be raptured and we're all going to be going there and we're going to have this guy come along. And I mean, I don't know, but he could have just been smoking gas.
So it sounds crazy, right? Before I ever tried any plant medicine, I was like, what the hell is this? Like seven-headed beasts and what?
Yeah.
And then I smoked DMT. And then the first time I ever smoked DMT, I was like, holy shit, Revelations must be real, you know, because that's the kind of things that you see there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's definitely, for me, and it's my belief, that there is a connection between the psychedelic entheogenic, which means connecting with the divine within experience, and the Bible and the 100%. Experiences that were told in the Bible. So that's just what I
would agree. I would agree. Just don't tell that to any Christians, please.
Hey, no, come on. Well, it's okay. She told it to me. I'm good. But definitely there are a lot of people that would, and it's just one of those things. They're just going to have to come to it on their own. I mean, it's too volatile. It says there's just too much of a social pariah in our common day to day that people just associate it with something criminal. And, you know, there's just
that's
no way.
It's really weird now, because historically and anthropologically, there is evidence that all of our ancestors on every single continent yeah. used these.
Of course they did.
Entheogens.
They were probably
sacramentally and ceremonially.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
of our yeah. ancestors. Yeah.
So. They were probably taught by an angelic being, let's say, you know, that was yeah. here, there, that plant right there. That'll give you a great insight into what God's thinking today, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe it's the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. There you go.
I think so.
It's marijuana. It's ayahuasca.
Yeah, I think so. I really do.
I would totally agree. Like you said, for thousands and thousands of years, all of our ancestors did it. It was done mm-hmm. ceremonially, it was done spiritually, it was done for healing. But then we get to the late 19th and early 20th century, and they start to put the bans on it and making things illegal. And so why did this happen? In your opinion, why did we go from, yes, we're all doing it and it's growing us, to don't do it anymore? It's now illegal.
I mean, you think about why our founding fathers came to America, right? They're looking for religious freedom. You know, we say the war on drugs. I think it's the war on beliefs. There were certain religions. If you look at the pagans, for example, there were certain beliefs that when Christianity, the church, specifically the Catholic Church, came in, that you were no longer allowed to believe certain things. They wanted everybody to believe the same thing. And I love conspiracy theories. They're super fun. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. if we're taking a logical approach, if we're taking a logical approach, right? What yes. did the church want? Yeah. What did the Catholic Church want? What did the Catholic Church kill for? It's control.
Yes.
Right? And so for me, I have this theory and I share it a lot. There was a time when we walked this earth in complete symbiosis with the mushroom specifically, is what I think. It was a part of our consciousness. It was a part of our DNA. It was a part of our life. And we kind of, we worked together. And in that those times, you see these megalithic structures that we can't replicate today. And everybody's like, it was aliens. They're like, we still don't know how they were built, right? Mm-mm. And a lot of people are ready to believe like aliens descended from the sky to build mm-hmm. pyramids. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I think that we had a power of resonance that we learned from the mushroom. And I think my ancestors, the pharaohs, and I've had trips where I've seen things like this, I think that they had such a symbiotic relationship with the mushroom, this organic, intelligent technology, that they learned things from this organic technology that travels through space on asteroids, by the way. It's been around longer than the Earth.
Fungus?
Yeah.
The fungus? Really?
Yes. Yeah. And I think that they were able to access more of their brain than we are able to access today. You know, we can access 10% of it. I think they maybe could access 50% or more, because scientifically, psilocybin promotes neurogenesis. That's the new growth of neurons mm-hmm. and neural pathways in the brain. So yeah. that's a fact. We know that.
Yes.
So I think they could access more of their brain when they had the symbiotic relationship with the mushroom. And that's how they were able to do the things that they did that we're not able to do in modern day.
Well, we might be able to do it, but it hurts the earth more now. And, you know, it's just generates more power than it's worth.
Yeah.
Right. We have air conditioning, right? But it's like sitting there buzzing and ruining our electric, you know, we're pulling all this power, whereas theirs was like free and
right.
way
well,
cooler.
I urge you, if you haven't, to go do some research on Nikola Tesla and the things yeah. that he learned about energy and electricity. You know, that's a rabbit hole in and of itself.
Did he take a lot of ayahuasca?
I'm not sure.
I don't think he even needed it. he was born with it. Maybe his mom did.
He was already talking to beings and stuff like that. I mean, we did an episode on Nikola Tesla, and you know, he would sit there and basically say that he was receiving transmissions and information, and you know, and then people, again, like you had said, Simone, that people want to say, well, he was receiving transmissions from aliens, you know. Well, I think where you're going makes more sense, that if he was tapped into the Akashic records or whatever, this other world, like he was tuned in where most of us are tuned out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
he just lived on a different frequency.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there was a time when all of our ancestors lived in that frequency that he tapped into. There's an abundance of energy in this space that seems empty between us. You know, this is just air. But no, it's filled with energy, and there's an abundance of energy. There's no scarcity of energy when you're living in that frequency, right? But the point of everything I was saying was that I research secret societies, and I'm going to try really hard to not get into like a conspiracy mode.
This is good. I get where you're going.
Okay, cool. So that there was a time when that all humans were in symbiosis with the mushroom. That relationship was severed. I really dove into when that relationship was severed, specifically for my ancestors, the pharaohs. And so in my research, I learned that the first secret society was in Egypt, and it was called the Brotherhood of the Serpent.
Mm.
Yes, and that secret society is linked to Catholicism, the Vatican, and the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea, for those that don't know, were the ones that took books out of the Bible, and they edited the Bible to be, you know, the New King James Version or whatever. That led to be the New King James Version, right? It's the Bible we have today. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you know, I believe that there was a moment when somebody was like, wow, there's so much power in this organic technology that is the mushroom. What if no one knew about it and only I knew about it? Then I would have dominion. Mm-hmm. And I would have power and control over reality and, you know, and I think that sentiment was felt by many groups of people who ended up controlling and taking power and ultimately severing our relationship with these plants and fungi. And instead of, you know, the general population having access to this mushroom power, it was limited to these secluded tribes, and then, you know, things progressed and the Council of Nicaea fed everybody beliefs and went as far as to kill people for not believing what they believed or what they were telling you to believe. And so I have nothing against Christianity. Like I said, my entire family is Christian. I believe in a lot of parts of the Bible, just I see it from a different perspective now.
Sure.
But to look at people who were liberated and could access their brain and create new neural pathways and heal themselves and be in harmony with the environment, and then to tell them that you're a sinner and you need a savior, it takes away personal power. Right. And it really changes reality. And that's why we see, you know, the ancient world looked so different than the world looks today. And it looked to me, you know, when I stand in front of the pyramids or I stand in Luxor and Aswan in Egypt and I see the great palaces of the pharaohs, it's way more intelligent than what we have today.
Yeah.
So it raises a lot of questions.
No, it certainly does.
Heck yeah.
What you're saying absolutely makes sense if we start to look at what's happened, you know, over the last 100+ years here in America. Because what you're saying is many years ago, you had people who were like, I want to take the power. I want to have all the control. And, you know, it kind of goes back to with, you know, even in Judaism where they're like, yo, sorry, no one can read the Torah. We read the Torah. So if you're not informed, We can control you. So I think what you're saying is absolutely correct. So when you come back to the States here 100 plus years ago, they go, oh, even back in the 60s, they go, we're losing a little bit of control. We got too many people thinking for themselves.
We got to get fluoride in the water.
All that stuff, right? And what's amazing to it as well, you know, in part of this war on drugs story is who were the scapegoats in all of it here in the States? And it was the black community and the Hispanic community.
Big time. Huge. Yeah. This is one thing I brought up with Michelle. I said, you know, there are recordings of Nixon in his office chatting with whomever, and maybe not even just Nixon, probably a couple other presidents before him, Lyndon Johnson or whatever, going,
Nixon was the only fool who was like, you know what, I'm gonna record everything.
I know, right? But they're telling their guys, yeah, this is the perfect in, if you will, to go after a community of people that really gives us the right. Because we'll, you know, that's where, if we make this stuff illegal, we can go after. But like, just there's old recordings. Like, that's very, very much, it needs to be out there and just heard, because it's so, I think one thing I definitely see in all of it, you know, like you said, Simone, with the power, right? You know, the pyramid on the back of the dollar bill, there's the Eye of Ra, right? The knowledge, mm-hmm. the little group of people that know the knowledge, right? The truth. Yes. Versus everybody else in the pyramid. You know, you stay where you're supposed to stay and shut up and do your thing. Like, don't question it. You're going to be in this part of the pyramid. But I look at that and I go, and in the same kind of house, there lives the pharmaceutical companies, right? That make trillions of dollars every year for us to be continuing our journey in life and continuing to be sick, not healthy, right? They make trillions on us being sick, not well. They make trillions of us, you know, being, I'm sure NyQuil would, if the cure for the cold came out, NyQuil or Tylenol or whoever, they'd be like, no, that's our bread and butter, right? We can't take that away. And I think, you know, even Jesus Christ, right? What did he say? The root of all evil is the love of money and greed, and you know, that love of money and power. And it's so when you really look at it from that level, I mean, it's a sick thing that somebody did to ruin it for all of us. Maybe let's look at it that psilocybin truly is a way to heal us from cancers. You know, if we could look at our body, leave our body for a second and go, oh, that's what's wrong with me, and heal it or think about healing it, you know, because our mind is truly more powerful. But those in charge, and it is a conspiracy theory. Everybody's going to go, well, Tim, come on now. You're being a crazy person. I'm not being crazy. These people are ruled by greed. Families of generational wealth, ruled by greed, ruled by power, and they do not want to lose that power.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I don't think it's a conspiracy. I don't think it's a conspiracy to think that the people in power are exploitative. I mean, that's clear.
Right.
The profiteering is there. There's tangible evidence. These people are making billions of dollars off of patented compounds. These people are making billions of dollars. Like, you look at Monsanto, you know, they're making billions of dollars trying to control nature, right? And that's tangible evidence. So it's not, I wouldn't call that a conspiracy. The profiteering exploitation is a fact.
But you know, the second you call something a conspiracy, everybody's minds go, okay, right? So that's all anybody has to do. That's all they have to do is say, that's a conspiracy, and everybody checks out. Because they're brainwashed.
That's what they've been trained. We've all been trained that. Rockefeller, back in the early stages of America, when we were kind of getting out of war, you know, Civil War, right? 1920s. It's well documented that big families like Rockefellers and whatnot put a lot of money into schools. And to our learning, because they wanted to continue to beat the drum that you are going to be in this status level the rest of your lives. And if somebody has conspiracy theory saying otherwise, they need to be rejected. Everybody reject that guy, right? That is crazy. Let's get back in line and do what we're saying, right? Do the thing.
Yeah.
Live the model we want you to live.
Absolutely.
Don't question it.
I think it's important to note too, I really did want to bring this up about the Controlled Substances Act that the Nixon administration rolled out. I really want to bring up what was going on in the world and in the States during that time. You're looking at a time when the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement were going on simultaneously. Those were two very powerful movements. And I like to say this to be clear. The Controlled Substances Act was in response to those movements because Timothy Leary was giving everybody acid. And, you know, the story in the early 70s, late 60s. And this revolution was bred out of this psychedelic experience. And they were not quiet about it. And so I really do believe that the Nixon administration responded to these revolutionary movements by making psychedelics specifically illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Because there were those during that time, I think it was the late 60s, early 70s, they were doing studies on LSD and the efficacy of LSD on military personnel. And the story goes that they gave these soldiers LSD. And while they were sitting with the LSD, they came to realizations like, why am I doing this? Like, war is bad. Why are we? Yeah. And so they were like, oh, shit. This isn't working the way we thought it was going to work.
Illegal.
Right.
Well, that's how, like, in the Nazis gave their soldiers basically meth pills. Because it was like, it was a total opposite. So you got Americans over here going like, okay, what can we do? What can we give them that's going to maybe numb them so that they just do something, right? We do what they're told. And it was a complete opposite of what they expected. And on the other hand, you got the Nazis saying, we got this meth pill that, well, it's a killing machine, man. It's a killing machine.
Yeah.
And we got it from our seance gal, the gal that was in Hitler's camp. Without a doubt, she probably is the one that discovered the recipe from some evil, dark being. Right. So what was that again? It was lithium battery acid. Yeah, and I cook it with what? How is that possible?
What is interesting is, you know, I've done some reading. We've just had an experience here within our household of a family member, my stepfather, who had dementia and recently passed away. And, you know, with all that, you go, well, thank you. But with all that, you start looking at things. And like you had mentioned, with the neurons, with psychedelics.
Yeah,
neurons. They can reconnect these neurons. You know, obviously, at some point, I think, you know, you're too far gone. But is there, and I'm at the point of almost experiencing with, you know, trying to start experiencing with microdosing simply because I don't want to get there. If I can do something at my age now that I can take daily, that doesn't freak me out, right? Like I can be within my, you know, I can be with my children, be with my wife, work, all that kind of stuff, but it can start repairing damage that's already happening and prevent me to go down that road in the future. So studies have shown that that's a fact, that we can repair neurons.
Yeah, it's huge.
It's huge. So again, I think going back to what Tim said too, is they don't want it. There's all these things out there that say, man, we can heal your depression. No, you don't need a pill. Literally just to pick up that plant. Well, there's no money in that, right? There's no control.
No money
in that. Right? No. You know, we can almost do away with Alzheimer's, dementia.
But who's going to buy my $20,000 a bottle pill?
I can tell you this. My father-in-law, he took medication for years
and it didn't do anything.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, maybe it numbs you a little bit, right? You know, so you don't act out. But in the end, it's just money pouring out. There's no, you know, there's really no major side effects. Absolutely.
Nobody talks about how harmful and stressful these pharmaceutical drugs are on the heart. Yes. Cardiovascular disease is one of the leading killers of humanity right now. And you have to wonder. It's not just our food. It's all these medications that we're taking put stress on the heart and other organs. Mm-hmm. And if you read the fine print, it will say it'll be there. You know?
Oh yeah, they'll rush it by, right? May cause diarrhea, heart pain.
Their favorite thing to do is sudden death. If you're taking this medication, try this medication. It'll help with some of those other things that wasn't helping with. And my goodness, my
mom's fallen into that trap. I mean, she's older now. She just turned 69 and does have heart disease and does have diabetes. And she takes so many medications. Like for an example, she'll take one medication and it creates this restless leg syndrome. So they say, we have a medication for restless leg syndrome. And now she can't sleep, you know, and it's this whole plethora of pills. And I said it before in this podcast. I mean, doctors, not all, again, I won't say all, there are some great ones out there, but they are pill pushers. A lot of them are pill pushers. And I went and saw my heart doctor not too long ago. And you know, Simone, what he prescribed me? He said, I need you to exercise more and drink way more water. And I said,
thank you.
Oh my gosh. Mm. You didn't give me a pill. I was like, you're a good heart doctor. Thank you.
We don't want to shit on doctors. Right?
No, not at all.
Like it's not the doctors, not the good ones. It's the system, right?
It's the system.
Yes, that's fair.
There are doctors. So like Lyme disease, for example, it's a very prominent autoimmune disorder. And there are doctors that have treated Lyme disease by deworming people, so getting rid of parasites, and giving them a certain cocktail of minerals. And neuroplasticity training has been effective in treating autoimmune disorders. Well, you can get arrested and lose your license as a doctor if you do not treat Lyme disease the way that you're supposed to treat it, which is giving them antibiotics. Mm-hmm. It's like a 2-week course of antibiotics. And that's the only way a doctor is allowed to treat Lyme disease. And they can lose their license. They can get arrested for doing that. Can you believe that? It's fucking crazy.
It's mind blowing. My mother-in-law, she had breast cancer. And when she had it, she had to seek treatment in South America because the treatment up here was very, you can't. And there were some different things going on down there, you know, and, you know, fortunately for us, she's alive today and kicking and amazing. But that's not offered here in the States. Simone, like you just said, you know, they can be arrested. So, okay. You know what? That's kind of the first time I've heard that. So I do want to kind of dial back on my statement. That doctors are just pill pushers. They're being forced into it. It's not fair.
They're taught to do that. They go to medical school and that's the system that they learn to heal.
Yeah. And I do think they've been lied to. The Dope Sick is an incredible, if any of you out there haven't seen the show Dope Sick yet, I highly recommend it. Great actors in it. Michael Keaton's in it. I love Michael Keaton. He's typically one of my, go-tos when I'm watching. Yeah, he's fun. But he is a doctor in the show and, you know, and innocently was giving people the drug that Purdue was, you know, OxyContin. Purdue was saying to all the doctors, nobody's going to get addicted, kind of with your story, Todd. They're not going to get addicted. And it's just going to help them with their pain. And they would even create jargon that didn't even exist in any kind of medical, you know, journal. They would make it out of thin air and call it something just so that they could tell that this pill cures that, you know. And these doctors are just like you're saying, they're like part of the system. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Oh, and they're going to take you out to a fancy dinner and talk to you about a pill. Well, I trust these guys, of course.
Yeah, cool.
And, you know, now, of course, we see in the news where the Purdue's basically they're not allowed to live anywhere. I mean, people hate them. That whole family has just been a social pariah ever since the whole concept came out that they were ruining just small town America, you know, with their drug.
You know, what's amazing though, Tim, with these stories and like these documentaries and all this information, I mean, at any moment, and I tell my children, you can pull out this computer in your pocket and look up anything. So we're so informed today, but it only seems like there is a very small percentage of us that go, wait, I don't want that pill anymore. Wait, I want to take that, or, you know, I want to stop doing this.
There's no options.
Huh? Yeah, no option. There's no option.
They don't have other options.
That's truly fair. That's truly fair. But I do also wonder as well if we're just so easy to forget. As an example, maybe it's our generation, a little bit younger, that goes, no, we're opening our eyes to these things. But the older generation, like the boomers and stuff like that, they are quick to say, whatever my doctor says, whatever my doctor says, I'm in. You know, and I think we're a little
which
bit
which is more, weird because a lot of them came out of the 60s, right?
Yeah.
Free love.
Absolutely.
Doing the LSD. No, they're not.
Yeah. They've been conformed.
Yeah. Well, also that whole movement, that whole 60s, 70s movement was kind of frowned upon after the Nixon administration. And they were looked at as, you know, homeless losers, you know. Smelly. These are not successful people. If you want to be successful, don't do these drugs. And there was even propaganda. I don't know if you guys have seen some of these commercials from the early 70s.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? Yeah. And so the story was told, the stigma was built that if you're a free-loving hippie, you are not a successful member of society.
That's right.
Yeah. And then Steve Jobs created Apple.
But it's like you're saying, Todd, earlier, the whole like, man, we're losing control. Crap. Well, okay. So one of the media conglomerates that owns a big piece of the pie, right? Seven different media conglomerate owners out there. And they go, hey, guys, we better start doing Reefer Madnesses and get those back in circuit because we're losing a whole group of people to knowledge, to true open mind experiences. And we got to stop that.
So you're now involved with the Georgia chapter of Decriminalized Nature. Do you think with other chapters throughout the U.S. and they've gotten it passed in these cities, do you think that we're heading in the right direction to where, you know, these natural substances will not be criminalized anymore?
Yeah. I think it's important to note that decriminalized nature is decriminalizing to combat legalizing. So.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. There's a difference.
Either way, there's a big difference.
I get it.
So either way, we're in a psychedelic renaissance, right? Everybody's talking about it. Every major university is researching this. No matter what, the cat's out of the bag, that these are highly effective in treating mental disorders like PTSD, depression, you know, childhood trauma, eating disorders, alcoholism, addiction of any sort. So these there's tangible evidence now, and it's only going to snowball, right? And so smart investors see a curve, right? A social curve, and they want to come in here before it explodes. And so there's lobbyist groups, for example, the New Approach PAC. It's a lobbyist group that is funded by Monsanto. David Bronner.
Those guys again.
David Bronner, Compass Pharmaceuticals. Side note, Compass Pharmaceuticals is currently researching, they're trying to replicate the molecule psilocin. So when you ingest psilocybin mushrooms and you metabolize it, it breaks down into psilocin. Well, Compass Pharmaceuticals is saying, if we're going to give this to doctors to give to their patients, well, we need to homogenize the doses. If you're using natural mushrooms, there's no way to homogenize the doses. If we replicate this molecule psilocin, well, now I can give doctors homogenized doses of this magical medicine. And so they're working on patenting psilocin right now as we speak.
Wow.
And so New Approach Pack, who is funded by Compass and people like David Bronner and Monsanto, they're pushing a legalization model all over the country. They're spending millions of dollars lobbying to push the legalization model, which would have closed task forces for safety, and limitations on these medications, right? Or for that medication. So they're pushing the medical model. I don't know how much you guys followed the cannabis reform, but that was just a mess. Because when you push that medical dispensary model, it becomes inequitable as far as access is concerned. So the reason we're decriminalizing is because we're saying, no, we don't want to spend $6,000 to $10,000 for psilocybin therapy with a therapist. I want to grow my own mushrooms and eat them in the way my ancestors did. And so our biggest thing here is equitable access. You know, ketamine is legal here in Georgia. Well, some of these ketamine therapies cost upwards towards like $6,000 a session. You know, there are people in marginalized communities that need access to these alternative traditional healing modalities that can't afford to sit with a doctor and do it that way. So decriminalized nature, it's interesting because we are winning in all these cities and New Approach Pack is not. It's because this is what the people want. They want equitable access to nature. I mean, why does a doctor need to give me something that grows out of the ground? I don't go to the doctor to get my tomatoes. You know, it just doesn't make any sense. So that's what we're doing. We're really combating that movement, because whether we're here or not, these big corporations, these big pharmaceutical companies like Compass, they're going to try to make money off of this. You know, we all know, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
So there's a reason why we're decriminalized.
And it's going to turn it into a weird, sicker form of it.
Exactly. So we're really, really passionate about this and combating this and changing the paradigm. You know, we want bottom up control. We want local economies around these plants and fungi. We want equitable access. We have a grow, gift, gather kind of method that Oakland uses. So grow your own, gift it to your friends, you can gather it, and it's almost free to cultivate. And so it's revolutionary healing. And what it does is it liberates us. It makes us self-sustaining. And powerful people don't want us to be self-sustaining because they provide all these things for us. And they make money. Every time we have to rely on the system, they get a check. And so that's really what the movement is about. It's what was created back in Oakland in 2019. It was a group of people who sat in a room and talked about these things. And they're like, wait, we need to stand up for this. Like, we need to fight for this. Like, they can't have this. This is ours. This is Earth's, you know, nobody can control this.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It's really special.
Simone, I did want to ask you, so looking at the movement that's going on, I did have some questions because, you know, as I'm looking at it and I'm looking at the socials and everything like that, it looks fun and it looks awesome. But my big question is, how do we get a little bit older generation or more conservative
group of people to buy into this movement. I guess, you know, when you're seeing some of these images and everything, and it does, you know, it looks like a bunch of young people having fun. It almost resembles the 60s kind of movement in Woodstock. You kind of think, you know, is that almost a turnoff to the more conservative? How do we get them on board if they're seeing that kind of stuff? Do you know where I'm going with it? You know, it's because we kind of want everybody education. Absolutely. So how do we go about that?
I've been advocating for this here in Georgia. I've talked to a lot of political figures. I've talked to a lot of people in general in Georgia. And Georgia is the first state in the South, really, that's pushing this. And when I brought this movement here, I was like, this is going to be hard. Because we have a lot of conservative, you know, Christian people. We're in the Bible Belt. And the first place I tested it out in, when I first brought this here, it was in February, and I'm a beekeeper, and I live in Cherokee County.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, so we have a farm in Cherokee County, and so I live around a bunch of very conservative people. We're all kind of farmers, homesteaders, self-sustaining is what we're about. And, you know, in my bee club, it's a bunch of old white guys. I love them. They're amazing.
Yeah,
I bet. Some of the best people I know, but it's all old white guys and then me. And so I got to know them a little bit. And one day at our bee club, they asked me, "Hey, Simone, what do you do?" And I kind of smiled like, "All right, here we go.
Here we go.
So I was like,
"Get your seatbelts on."
Yeah. So I told them, I was like, "I'm the executive director of Decriminalize Nature Georgia." They're like, "What's that?" And I was like, "Well, we're advocating for the decriminalization of entheogens." And they're like, "What's that?" I was like, "Entheogens are plant and fungi psychedelics." And I said the word psychedelics and they were like, "Oh."
Right.
And so then they're like, "Oh, here in Georgia, like, are you sure?" Like, and I was like, "Let me tell you the history." And I told them about the anthropological evidence that all of our ancestors used these plants and fungi sacramentally and ceremonially for thousands of years. And I told them that I believe it's unconstitutional for the government to tell me how I connect with the divine. And it was in the moment.
I gotta applaud that.
Thank you. It was in that moment when I said, "This is unconstitutional," that they were like,
the light bulb went off.
Right. They were like, "Yeah, why is the government telling us how to connect with nature?" And I was like, "You know, it's my fundamental belief that nature is inherently divine. And it is my religious practice to connect with nature in this way." And there are people like Greg Lake, the attorney who's been advocating and winning for people to make this their religious practice. And create churches, right? There's a list of things you have to do to have a church, right? So you have to write down your belief system. You have to have a practice. And he's been winning these cases and opening up churches here in our state. There are many of them where people can legally take these substances sacramentally because it's a part of their religious practice. So when you break things down like that, you say, this is a spiritual practice for people who are on our planet today, right? There are communities and cultures that are centered around this entheogenic divine experience with plants and fungi. Why in this country are we not able to practice that religion? We're allowed to practice all the other religions, but not that one. And so when I told them and I broke this down to them, by the time I left, they were like, "When can you get mushrooms?" And I was like, "They're growing everywhere." You know, like there are psychedelic mushrooms growing in the parks in Atlanta. And so the Nixon administration created a stigma on purpose. They propagated this stigma that people are taking these recreationally to like get fucked up and get out of their minds. And that's really not the reality. It's a made up stigma. The reality is people are taking mushrooms and having extremely transformative spiritual experiences. And so that's also what our movement is doing, is breaking the stigma and helping people understand what these plants and fungi are. There's a reason also that we're not advocating for synthetics like LSD or MDMA. We have nothing against the synthetics, but our platform...
It's not nature.
Yes. Our platform is being able to use the healing modalities that our ancestors used, and that all these tribes, there are hundreds of them around the world that are using these substances. And so it's specifically entheogens, plant and fungi, psychedelics. But, you know, I have not talked to a conservative yet that hasn't understood that concept of it's a spiritual practice.
Yeah, that's a beautiful way that you can break that down to somebody and really make them listen. I mean, that was well said, and I'm sure it was received well. You know, there's no way to, you're dead on the money when you say they're taking your rights away, because you're right. You know, they might not agree with psilocybin mushrooms. They may not, they don't understand it. They don't agree with it. That's illegal, right? The stigma.
Right.
But at some point, and I've said this for so many years, at some point, the government's going to take something that you do like. So what happens when they step in and say, I'm sorry, bees are regulated by this specific company now, and you can no longer do that and produce honey. Well, now people are up in arms. So again, when we start talking about things of freedom of speech and you know, the right to be free and practice what you want to practice and put in your body what you want to put in your body, it has to be all or none, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think our founding fathers weren't perfect people, but I think when they founded this country, I think that was this sentiment. You know, it was the freedom of belief and just, you know, freedom to practice what you want to practice. And so if we're following the Constitution and these lawmakers are trying to follow the Constitution, I think that there's a huge gap when it comes to these plant medicines right now. I think Absolutely. The laws are not unconstitutional, to be totally honest.
So here in Georgia, you're pushing for it. Now, I think you had mentioned to me that right now it's really just a focus per city all across the nation. So right now in Georgia, you're just focusing on Atlanta. Is that correct? No.
No. So Georgia's a funny city. We're trying in Atlanta, right? We have a sponsor who introduced our bill this month, Liliana Bechtiari. But even the city council members, we've gained a lot of support while we've been doing this. They told us that this is a state issue. And in Georgia, even if we decriminalize in these small cities, if we don't decriminalize statewide, it's not really decriminalized, you know?
Yeah.
And so they actually advised us, it was the DeKalb County commissioners and the Atlanta City Council members that advised us to take this up to the state. And next week, I'm actually reaching out to the Georgia General Assembly. I was given contacts by, you know, different council members and commissioners to start working on that, because they're already talking about that statewide. I don't know if you heard about the psilocybin. They passed a bill to allow research on the efficacy of psilocybin mushrooms and PTSD in our veterans in the state of Georgia. Okay. They have until December 1st to share their findings. I want to look it up, but I think if one of the senators introduced this, and he's a veteran, and he's a conservative veteran who's advocating for psilocybin mushrooms in Georgia. So
that's a big deal.
It's a huge deal. Yeah. I wish more people were talking about that, but I think it's a really, really good time for us to start talking about decriminalizing statewide. So that's our goal right now, is to completely decriminalize statewide. It's going to be hard, you know, we have to change people's minds, but we're just so passionate about this. And we want to time it right before the legalization model comes in, you know?
Yeah, I would agree with you, because legalization, you know, and break that down for us real quick, because I'm sure a lot of people don't fully understand that, because they think that legalization is the same thing as decriminalization. It is not. It is by far. It is totally different.
No. So legalization, I like to kind of explain legalization of entheogens as the legalization of cannabis. So to get cannabis, you have to go to a dispensary. That the person who runs that dispensary has to have a large amount of money that most people don't have. I think it's at least $1 million. Mm-hmm. And then the growers have to have, I think, $1 million to grow. And so the legalization model creates blockages. It makes it so that it's, like I said, it's not equitable for the consumer, because it makes it more expensive, because these growers and dispensaries have to have so much money to even run their business. And then it makes it inequitable, obviously, for legacy growers and, you know, home growers. And so the legalization model is created for profiteering. It brings in these substances as a business. When you decriminalize, there's no money involved. It's personal use. It's, I can grow my own in my backyard. When you legalize, you can't grow your own in your backyard. You know, if they legalize weed, marijuana, and if you grow it in your backyard, you can get arrested. Because you have to have a license to grow it and to sell it. So it takes away our freedoms.
It does. Yeah, 100%. And, you know, as a libertarian, one of the ways that we kind of classify decriminalization versus legalization is legalization, the government still has their hand in the cookie jar, right? They're still controlling it. They can still tell you what to do. They still have all the power in it. Decriminalization means it's not a crime. It's not legal. It's not anything. It's a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
It's just whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It blows my mind, but I think you're right. I think people are waking up. I think organizations such as what you guys are doing are brilliant. Even, you know, little shows coming on Netflix that kind of got me thinking. Obviously I thought this way anyways, Tim. I think Josh, we all think this way. We're very center-minded on this, you know, and open to it, but watching that documentary and going, whoa, that's cool that they did that out in Oakland. Is there anything here? So that's how it starts. And, you know, you keep those conversations going, and even people like me that watch it on there, and I talk to my two friends and I say, hey, there's this organization. So it's super cool. What events, what things you guys have coming up that maybe people that are in the Atlanta area can go out and be a part of?
So we meet, at Cultured South, a fermentation company. It's in the West End in Atlanta. Every last Wednesday of the month at 7 p.m.
All right.
It's a beautiful community filled with doctors, neuroscientists, law enforcement officers, psychotherapists, you know, people from all walks of life. And it's, you want knowledge, you want support, you want to just talk about psychedelics in a way where it's not stigmatized, that's the place to go. Psy Atlanta is the Psychedelic Club of Atlanta. They meet every Wednesday at Cultured South. They're huge supporters of us. We're like family, partnered with them. And so they, after their meeting on the last Wednesday of every month, Decriminalized Nature comes in and we have a little powwow. But Psy Atlanta, huge shout out to them. What they're doing, they've been doing it for a while here. It's really beautiful to see, you know, a psychedelic culture emerging, in a city in the South like that. So, Psy Atlanta, incredible. Thank you. I hope you guys are hearing this.
Thank you, Psy Atlanta. You're the best.
Yeah. But also, I encourage everybody to go on our website, www.decriminalizenaturegeorgia.org. Right on the landing page, you can submit your email. If you give me your email, then you're on a newsletter, and I send out a newsletter about once or twice a month to keep people up to date if they can't make it to our meetups. And then we also have an open forum Telegram channel called Decriminalize Nature Georgia, where people can stay up to date. And you can follow us on Instagram, which is our Instagram. It's Decrim, D-E-C-R-I-M, Nature Georgia. And I would also advise everybody to follow the national Instagram page, and that's Decriminalize Nature.
Amazing. Amazing. Yes. Did somebody already take Decriminalized Nature Georgia? Somebody already had that?
No, nobody had that one. It was just shorter. If I spelled it all out, it was so long. So a lot of the chapters nationwide do decrim and then their city.
Okay. Their state. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That makes perfect sense. We all have enjoyed having you on. And I,
yep.
Oh my gosh. I've learned so much today. Seriously. It's amazing. Yes.
And you got to spread again, the knowledge.
Oh my gosh. And I hope that this helps propel it just a little bit more, you know, with what we're doing on the podcast. Much. Oh my gosh. You're lovely. You're enjoyable.
Thank you.
You spoke with just enthusiasm and intelligence with what's going on. And, you know, I think that resonates, and that takes out that kind of stigma of, you know, these are just hippies that want to go out there and get high and experience. It takes all that out of there. And, you know, and you're a great person to kind of lead this charge here in Georgia. And we're so grateful to have you on.
I mean, you keep bees, for heaven's sakes.
Yes, I do.
I don't keep bees.
Yeah, we actually use mycelium to we sprinkle mycelium powder on our bees to keep mites and beetles out of their hives.
Brilliant.
Can I have a jar of that, honey?
Yeah, it's not psychedelic mycelium.
Tripped out, honey.
Dang.
Psychosyllabin honey. Yeah, right. You heard it here first.
Let me give you all my conclusion on the war on drugs. The war on drugs was and is nothing more than a way for governmental forces to control the masses. Clearly, a government that needs its cattle, us, to fall in line, cannot be free-thinking and emotionally healed. They need us numb, broken, and impoverished so that we can depend on them. Do people abuse drugs? Absolutely. However, drug use is not any more abused than the legal substances of alcohol, cigarettes, or big pharma-prescribed opioids. Why are these items legal? Because they are a polar opposite of the mind-expanding substances that have been classified as illegal. They make you sick, dependent, and weak. Exactly where the government wants you to be. If you think that we are anything more to them than slaves to their system, it's time to open your eyes and ask yourself these questions. Am I truly free to be who I choose to be? Consume what I choose to consume? Heal my mind and body naturally without persecution? Let me answer those questions for you. The answer is no, you are not. Simone, again, thank you so much. It's been great having you.
Thanks, Simone.
Thank you so much.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Truly inspirational.
Spread the knowledge, guys.
Yeah, everybody out there, humble yourself and just do some research.
Yes.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Be sure to subscribe to the Created by Human podcast. Leave us a review. Follow us on our socials at Created by Human. Head over to createdbyhuman.com for additional information. Sign up on our mailing list and check out our Created by Human swag. Does it just sound like gibberish? We'll be back next week with an all new story that is sure to make you question, is it true or was it?
Created by Human.